Greetings, everybody, and welcome to Whiskey and the Writings. I'm your host, Joe. Thanks for joining me today as we continue on our conversation, drinking some whiskey, reading the Bible, and I hope you're ready for this. Today I've got some Uncle Nearest once again. It's a classic, and plus it's what I have on my liquor cabinet right now. So we're going to go ahead and sip on some of this. 1856 is what I'm drinking. I got my ice and my drink, and we got our Bible. And so grab what you have in front of you, whatever Bible, pour your drink, take a sip. Let's begin. So we've been going through a conversation. This is part three of our Genesis chapter one. And as we've been working through this chapter, we've been learning a lot about what God's up to, who he may be talking to, and how that might relate to us. And so the beginning is chapter one, verse one and two. That's part one of our series. I encourage you to go back and take a watch for that if this is you just jumping right in. That'll set the stage as to what's happening here. And then our part two series is the different separating and filling acts that God does. This is the light from darkness, separation, the waters from waters, separation, the water from land, separation. So he's creating space. And then in day four, five, and six, he's filling up those spaces. So he's putting the sun and moon and stars and in the light and darkness separation. He's putting birds and sea creatures in the separating of waters and in the expanse. And then he's putting land animals on the land with trees and things like that, vegetation. So that's where we're at in this part of the story. And once again, I cannot stress highly enough to go and check out those videos to get that overview of what we're talking about here. So there's a lot happening behind the scenes. And now we're at the point where this is considered maybe like the culmination of this whole kind of creation moment. So this whole time, God's been creating a home for the inhabitants to live in. And now it's time for the humans to be created so they can move into this home. And so we pick up here in the story in chapter 1, verse 26. And so if you have your Bibles open, go ahead and take a look here. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, at what is happening here. This is how it reads according to the NET, which is what I have. So in the NET we have, "Then God said, let us make humankind in our image." Now, depending on the translation that you have in front of you, there are some translations that will use the word man, this word Adam. And specifically speaking here, this is problematic in that when we hear the word man, we think of often a singular male human being. And so when translators choose the Hebrew to translate into English the Hebrew word Adam, which technically does mean man in English, they are being true in the sense that it's being translated truthfully, but it doesn't actually get to the sense of the word, because that word Adam doesn't mean a singular male human being. It represents humans, humankind is what this word is trying to use. And it can be confusing because we go, well, wasn't that first man in the story? Wasn't his name Adam? Yes. But that's later on in the biblical narrative. At this point in time, and we'll get to that when we get into Genesis chapter 2, in Genesis chapter 3, how do we know that this is a singular, how do we know the difference between a singular male human being versus all of humanity? Those are great questions, and we'll have future videos talking about that. For now, most current translations, and when I say current, I mean the kinds of translations that are trying to get at the heart of what this is saying, those scholars will actually use words like this one, humankind, or God made humans, or mankind is another word that you're going to see there, because it's not talking about a singular person. It's talking about humans. The human race is what God makes. So in day six, God is making the human race. And so to future drive that point home, it goes on like this. The humans are made in our image, okay? And if you're slowing down when you read the Bible, immediately you should be going like, our? Okay, who else is there, right? Okay, and whose image, what other image is there in the our? That's plural. That's a great question. After our likeness, okay? So what we have here is that the point here in this is to understand that the humans were created to bear an image, to be a representative, a likeness to the thing that's creating them and forming them. There's so much to unpack here that this video just can't cover. So we will cover what does it mean to be human in a different video in the future. But for now, picture this. God, after he forms the animals, after he creates the trees and lets the trees produce fruit, he then moves on to a part of the creation that is ontologically different than anything else he has made. Up until this point, he hasn't said anything like, the cows are made in my image and our likeness, or that they even should be, or the birds, or the sea creatures, or the stars and the moon. None of those carry with it this aspect of additional intentionality. What I mean by that is that at this point, this God has a special and unique purpose for this set of humankind. And what's beautiful about this is we've been doing this in every video so far, this put yourself in the shoes of the person sitting around the campfire hearing this for the first time. Questions like, what God is this? What is this all about? What is this God up to? How is this God different than all the other gods who only care about the things I have to give them? And for the first time, we're introduced to a God that is actually giving to these humans. He's not taking from them. He's imparting onto them a distinction that sets them apart from any other creation up until this point. And so this kind of story, it would have been so new and so different to be made in the likeness and the image of the Creator, imparts onto the humans, which we are, something special, something different, something unique. And this verse 26, I just can't even begin to express how super rad this is. In the course of human history, there's been nothing like it, that the gods, this God is doing something that has not been done in human history at this point. Imagine yourself hearing this for the first time. And it reveals to us this dynamic that we have inherent within us a likeness to the Creator. We are His images. Now, that word image, if you were to really deep dive that word image, what does it mean to be an image? I mean, this question has been wrestled with by theologians for centuries, rabbis for centuries. this idea of what does it mean to be an image. And what I find fascinating about this word image, Carmen Joy Imus, I think that's how you say her last name, wrote a couple books that have been profoundly, I think, influential on this topic. I'll link to them in the show notes. Bearing God's name and Bearing God's Image, these two works. And I read I've read both of them, but when I read Bearing God's Name, she does such a fantastic job of unpacking the depth of what this reality means for us. And so, for instance, this word idol, it's the Hebrew word selam. And it's the same Hebrew word that you get in the Ten Commandments in Exodus. And so, you know, whether you know the Ten Commandments or not, you know probably of the Ten Commandments. And it's the set of rules, you know, the Moses coming down with the tablets and he has on it. And one of the very first rules in the commandments is that the Israelites were not allowed to make an image or an idol. I just gave it away there, didn't I? An idol of God. They weren't allowed to make idols. And that word idol there is the same Hebrew word, selam. And so idol, image. What's God up to in the Ten Commandments in Exodus? What he's up to is essentially saying, I don't want you to make a carved idol of me, an image of me. Well, why not? Why, God, why wouldn't you want us to have something that represents you? And it's as if God in the Ten Commandments is telling Moses, because I've already done that. You are the representation of me. You are the image. You are the idol. I don't need you to make something else. That would be a distortion of the original. We are the original idols. We are the original images. And so we're not supposed to make something of ourselves. That, like, do you see what I'm saying here? God's done it. We don't need to do it again. This is beautiful. Did you know that you are an image of God? That you have an ability to bear the likeness of God? Like, come on now. Like, inside of you, there is something ontologically, inherently beautiful because you bear the likeness of the Creator. All of humanity does. And so right out of the gate, God says, we're going to make humans and they're going to be different. They're going to be the likeness of us. I love how N.T. Wright, theologian, he's a British theologian, has done profound work on this reality of, like, what does it mean to be an image? And he says, to be an image is like an angled mirror. And so the image I have in my mind when I say angled mirror, have you ever been down one of those hallways that, you know, you have the corners, and in the top of the corner, there is a mirror. And so if you're walking down one way, you can see down the other direction. Or if someone's coming this way, you can see back. So you can see whatever is coming your way. Think of that we are like that mirror, that as people look at us, they should be able to see God. And so it's this reality that we live in, that we ought to embody the characteristics of this God that we are being told about, okay? And so at the very, like, onset of this chapter is an introduction to the kind of God who made everything and then prepared that everything to be a residence, a home for these people that he calls humans, that they ought to then reflect himself. And so this is the craziness of this first chapter, is that it's doing so much to reveal to us who we are and what's inside of us. Okay, I had to cut there. I got interrupted, but I'm back. And we probably need to move on. So I was probably rambling a little too much there. Let's go ahead and continue reading. So you have humans that are created. They are made in the image and likeness. And says, so they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the cattle, over the earth, and over all the creatures that move on the earth. And so there is a vocational aspect to the identity creation that takes place. So the humans are created and they reflect the image. That's their identity. They're in the likeness. They reflect the creator back into the earth. That's the image, the two-way mirror thing that we were talking about. And so that's an identity aspect. But then there's a vocational aspect. So humans have been asking this question since the dawn of time. Who am I and why am I here? Who am I and why am I here? This is about identity. This is about vocation. What is this thing called me? And what am I supposed to do with this life, right? So in the opening chapter of Genesis chapter 1, you are being presented with the answers to these fundamental questions of life. Who am I? Well, you are a reflection of the Creator. You're something that's different than anything else. Well, what am I here to do? Well, there is a governing that takes place, a stewarding that takes place. All of this thing that you've seen created, these animals, they are there for you to steward, to care for. So then there's this poem that the author begins to recite. And so there's a section here that's this beautiful poem that kind of summarizes this moment in the story. And it says this: God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. So this is another clue here that, like, when we get to God creating man, like the Adam, it's not talking about a singular human being, because here in this poem, it's very much referencing the male-female aspect to humanity, that humanity represents a male-female dynamic, and the two together are the image-bearing creatures that God has set up to govern and to steward this home that he has created for us. And then verse 28, it says this, and so here we have more of the vocation, right? What are we here to do? Why are we even here? So an ancient listener sitting around the campfire, taking his glass of whiskey, going, all right, tell me more. So this God, he ordered and made everything function. He created this home for me. Sounds great. He wants me. And then he made me. And I'm not just an accident. I'm not something that's here just to simply to be ruled over, that I'm actually someone who's in charge. And I'm actually someone who reflects the Creator, that I have a likeness of the Creator. Well, that's new information. But still, I got to wake up tomorrow and go to work. So what should I be doing? Right? So this is in the back of the mind. It says this in verse 28. We're not done with the story, right? So God blessed them, male and female. He blessed them, okay? He blessed them. This is an action of approval. This is an action of a statement of saying that this thing that I've done, it is good. And he said to them, so now he's speaking directly to them. So does he speak to the birds? No. Does he speak to the fish? No. Does he speak to anything? No. He speaks to them directly, okay? This is different. In the past, it's that God said and these things appear, but now God's looking at these humans and going, now I'm talking to you, okay? He says this, be fruitful and multiply. So this concept of be fruitful and multiply is this thing that says, go produce. Make more of you, sure, right? But this isn't simply about reproduction. This is about a calling to make something. To be fruitful, you need to create the space by which things can be made. And humans are really good at that, aren't we? Like at our core, we bring agriculture into the world. We bring technologies into the world. We bring medicine into the world. We are people that bring fruit. We do things that produce things, right? And then we multiply. Well, we're really good at that too. Am I right? But then he says, fill the earth and subdue it. Oh my gosh. Now, I could spend hours talking about this very concept because it just invokes so many questions already. Fill the earth. The question is, should we stay put? This thing that God did, it wasn't meant to stay there. Like, at the very core, this God says, go. Go, be, do. That actually is the blessing. Produce things everywhere. Everywhere you go, do something great. When people ask me, what should I do with my life? I think God goes, and this is what my response would be. I think God would say, go. Go do something that you want to do. Be fruitful. Like, God wants you to continue this ongoing work that he started here. And that's the beauty of this story. This God actually invites us to go and be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And this word subdue, it's literally to bring to order, to force into submission. Now, we can take this as a negative, and oftentimes it can be taken as a negative, but in this context, it means something very different. So for instance, if you have a garden, or let's just say you buy a plot of land, and you enter into that plot of land and you look in the backyard, and in the backyard, there's weeds and there's dirt and it's been like this for years, right? And so there's all sorts of like overgrowth and the dirt is hard. And if you were to try to plant a garden, you wouldn't go out and just take your pumpkin seed and just throw it out there and hope that something happens over the course of the next few weeks. No, you would have to subdue the earth. This is a gardening term, which is to literally, like, if you were to take your hands or a machine and put it in the earth and you were to force the earth to be something that produces something good. And I wonder if, like, I get so excited talking about this because there's a connection to, like, why does God highlight, like, all the seed-bearing fruits and, like, you know, at the beginning of day six and bear trees that bear seeds that bear fruit? Because there's this aspect of what God's doing is he's planting a garden, and gardens require seeds for it to continue its growth. And so to plant a seed in areas of the earth, if we're to fill the earth, imagine that earth is not cultivated yet. And so God put humans here to cultivate the earth, to turn the earth over so it would be something that can actually produce fruit. Do you see what's happening in this chapter? Like, from verse 26 all the way down to like verse 28 where we're here is mind-blowing. Like, this is the beauty. This is the setup for the rest of the Bible. If we can get our minds wrapped around what God originally wanted us to do, when we read the rest of the Bible, it becomes so much more clear, especially in the times that we get it wrong and we're actually not producing good bearing fruit. Is it any wonder that Jesus talks a lot about that you will tell a tree by its fruit, which is a parable metaphor to say, like, you can tell what kind of person you are by the things that come out of you. Here we have the very beginning of that. The idea here is that we are to subdue, which is to go into the earth and create spaces where life can flourish. Let's just that sink in for a second. We are reflections in the likeness of the Creator, created so that we can continue the ongoing work of creating spaces where life can flourish. Verse 29. Then God said, I now give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the entire earth. Ah, see seed-bearing again. And every tree that has fruit. Oh, this idea of bearing fruit again. With it, with seed in it. Here we are again. This will be yours for food, and all the animals of the earth, and every bird of the air, and all the creatures that move on the ground. Everything that has living breath in it, I give everything. Green plant food. Every green plant food. It was so. God saw, verse 31, all that he made. Like God sits back and he looks over everything that just happened in these previous verses. And he goes, it's very good. There was evening, there was morning, the sixth day. Conclude chapter one. Man, God looks at everything and says, it's very good. The Hebrew word there again is tov. It is very tov. This good that God looks at is not a mistake. This world is not a mistake. You are not a mistake. In fact, all of this is very good. Now, you may be coming from a perspective, or maybe someone has shared a perspective of you that this earth is bad, and that humans are bad, and that everything is bad, and God just needs to destroy it all and start over again because it's all bad. Here's my question for you. If that's kind of like, well, Joe, I was told this. Here's a question to wrestle with. Can God make a mistake? Can God make a mistake? I don't think he can. Maybe you do. And if God said everything was good, don't you think he meant it? Which is to say, was it not good later? And you go, Joe, well, what about the fall, chapter 3? We'll get to chapter 3 in another video. But at the very beginning, at least we can say this. What God did in chapter 1 was very good. And the question we got to wrestle with within ourselves is, do we believe that? Do we believe that what God created was good? And you might go, well, Joe, yeah, like what about sin, nature, and all these like things that we bring into the text? Oh, absolutely. We can address that. In fact, I have to some degree in a writing that's on storiesoftov.com that I'll link to in our show notes, where I talk about sin and what sin is and how maybe we ought to rethink what sin is. So I encourage you to go read those posts, and I'll probably do a video about those at a later time. But for now, just sit in the reality that what God did was good, that humans were meant to be good, that this earth was meant to be good. And if it was good to begin with, do you think it's worth making good once again? And that, I may argue, is what the rest of the Bible is all about. Listen, this was chapter frickin' one of the Bible. And we took three parts to get through it, and we didn't even scratch the surface. But maybe, just maybe, you learned something new. And if that's the case, leave me a comment. Like our video, subscribe to Whiskey in the Writings. Let us know what you think. Thank you for watching this inaugural three-part series on Whiskey in the Writings. Glad to have you. And until next time, cheers.